Welcome to A Place in Between. If you've ever felt like you just don't quite belong anywhere, this is your place. The mission here is to look beyond simple answers and certainties and dive into the messy spaces of life. I'm your host, Rocky McCormick, the queen of messes and misfits. In this very first episode, I want to take some time to break open the gooey, messy middle, kind of like a Cadbury egg, which, by the way, are kind of gross. Don't at me. But I want to talk about what the middle is and what it is not. We hear a lot about gray matter and gray areas, and because words are important and can be so easily misunderstood, I want to offer some definitions and background as to my meaning in using them as we go forward. So what is it I mean by a place in the middle or a place in between? A lot of times you'll hear the use of middle ground as a compromise of sorts, compromising of values, or maybe an accusation of sitting on the fence. I want to be clear that this is not what I'm speaking about, nor will I be inviting others into conversation around how we can avoid taking a stance on issues that affect our lives through a lens of faith. This isn't about being lukewarm. On the contrary, this place in the middle, the messy middle of that Cadbury egg, is that place where the perfect ideal meets the imperfect reality. It's that place that we spend our lives aiming for heaven while being fallen in sin. It's like that Matt Maher song, "We are less than perfect, but more than flesh and bone." So what does life look like in this space? What does life look like away from soundbites and 140 characters? This is an invitation to put context around our passion. I don't think anyone will argue with me when I say that public discourse has become increasingly polarized, with each team waving their pennants and hats. Slogans have replaced dialogue, real dialogue. We throw around our stances and opinions on the issues as though they exist in isolation from everyone else's lived experience. On any given post on social media, I can sadly almost guess who will share what. My goal is to be the one that throws you a curveball. The more I allow myself to be still and listen, the more I understand that the way forward is through nuanced conversations that sift through each other's stories. That is messy, it's vulnerable, it's risky, but I am convinced that it is in the middle of these stories that we begin to uncover the truth with a capital T. God doesn't work in abstract theory. He works in the mess of our lives. We have to begin to humanize the issues instead of letting the issues demonize humans. So long story short, after giving you the long story, the middle is the place where the issues intersect with our lived reality and where we wrestle with the tension of being caught in that place in between what we know to be ideal and our shortcomings and struggles in this life. All right, so we've covered the middle. Now let's dive into the gray. Gray matter, gray areas, there's a lot of shade being thrown toward the gray. What does gray matter have to do with gray areas, and how does that affect our conversations? It's a big question. Many of you may not know that much of my higher educational background is in political science and student development. I've left the campaign trail behind with very few regrets, and for the most part, I have little desire to return to educational administration. The lessons I've learned along the way, though, provide me a solid framework around what is happening now, I think. Let's start with the gray matter. We spend a lot of time in grad school learning about the different developmental theories, cognitive development, psychosocial development, moral development, and while I stink at rote memorization, because I couldn't name any of those stages if you paid me today, One thing that each theory impressed upon me is the gradual shift from simple, self-focused thought to a more mature ability to process multiple layers of information to negotiate our way through more complex issues. While there are many schools of thought and, not at all shockingly, conflicting research on these theories, there is in each a progression from egocentric thought patterns developed as a necessity to gain understanding of the world around us and to feel secure in it, to a learned ability to understand the world around us from multiple points of view. This theory of mind, or the ability to understand that different people have different thoughts, perspectives, feelings, etc., is developed by creating opportunities to experience and witness it in action. We grow in understanding by exposing ourselves to different perspectives, people with different stories and experiences, by adding layers of complexity to issues that otherwise center solely on our own experience, which is, by its nature, limited. To put it more concretely, if you create a three-dimensional diorama, but only allow someone to view it at eye level, from their height, and one direction, they will miss a great deal of the detail. For them to accurately create an understanding of the scene, they need to view it from all angles, different heights, and different perspectives. The same goes for our experiences and the issues we are facing. To arrive at a solution to the most dire problems of our time, we have to be able to come together to examine what is before us from all angles, and then to discern what is best. We can't do this if we only look at it from our own eye-level vantage point. Going back to the modes of cognitive development for a second, I want to address one thing: what fuels the earlier stages of development? In them, children are trying to gain a sense of security, of their place in the world relative to their environment. I'd like to consider for a moment that perhaps this polarized place we find ourselves in is a regression to that need to figure out who we are. I'm not saying we're being childlike, but maybe those of us who feel a need to dig in our heels at one end of the spectrum, whatever that spectrum might be, are doing so because we need to find some security in who we are in this ever-changing world where we find we have less and less control. Now, if we accept this to be the case, how do we encourage one another to step forward into a messier space, that place that's vulnerable and risky, that gray area in between? I think the secret is in our stories, the ability to tell them, and the ability to listen with an open heart. So let's talk stories. I was blown away by one line from a recent post by Rachel Cargill. In it, she reminded us that all of the history that most of us have learned in school, here in the U.S., the discovery of new lands, the exploration, all of it, was told from the perspective of European explorers. In truth, America wasn't undiscovered or uncivilized. It was quite inhabited, albeit with a different culture than one they knew. It was new to them. In my family's case, India was not undiscovered or uncivilized. It was quite ancient. But it was new to these explorers with a different culture. The story of the explorer is the mainstream narrative. I don't want to get into the issues of colonization or exploitation here and now, but I did want to share that perspective because I thought it was so powerful to explain the power of stories. Another pop culture take on it comes from Hamilton, which my husband is quite tired of me listening to. The question, who lives, who dies, who tells your story, is one worth considering. It raises the importance of claiming your story and telling it through your own experience, because that is the only way the story will share the intricacy of life as you know it. To that end, here is a little bit of my story. If you're familiar with it, I hope you'll still listen because it comes out a little differently every time. And who knows what will come to light today. The pieces of my story have shaped who I am today and how I've come to this particular point in my life where I feel it necessary to create a space to tell it. Now, the full story could be told over days, weeks, months, and years, so let's stick to the highlights for now. As Fräulein Maria says, let's start at the very beginning. Picture it, Sicily, 1954. Just kidding, that's Sophia from the Golden Girls. My story begins with my parents' immigration to the U.S. from Calcutta, India. I'm a first-generation Indian immigrant. My parents moved to the States in 1970. My mom and dad had been married for many years and were unable to have children, and so they moved to this country for better medical care and to see, kind of as a last-ditch effort, to see if they would be able to have some medical interventions that would allow them to have children. Now, prior to coming to the United States, my parents had applied to Australia. That was their first choice. But because of their race quotas, they were denied entry into the country and a visa. So my parents moved to New York City. They lived in Queens, and they lived there for 2 or 3 years, and then they lived in Connecticut for a couple of years, at which point my dad's company transferred him out to California. Now, while they were in New York, my mom, who has a master's in English literature, was trying to find a job, which it's quite hard to do without some work experience here in the States. And she landed, eventually, a job on Wall Street as an executive assistant. And so she has some great stories that she tells from those times, and just goes to show the moxie that that woman had to get herself a job on Wall Street. So they moved to California not too long after that, 1974, and in 1975, I came along, 15 years after my parents were married. So I always knew that I was very wanted and very loved. They moved across the sea to try to have me, and here I am. As I was growing up in the 70s with the economic issues, my mom didn't want to be raising me in a large city. We were in Los Angeles at the time, and my dad had lost his job. He'd gotten laid off. And so mom found him a position in the middle of Iowa, which is a far cry from Los Angeles, New York City, and Calcutta. So I grew up in small town Iowa, central Iowa, as a first generation Indian immigrant Hindu. And so I grew up feeling pretty lost. You know, we had good friends, we had great neighbors, but there was this longing to belong somewhere and not really knowing where my place was. I went through, you know, elementary school, where everyone's your friend, into junior high, where I didn't know how to navigate what was going on in the social world there, which just went on to high school to be more of the same. And it was when I was in high school that our neighbors at the time had a daughter a year younger than me, and she and I were out on the back porch one night. And I don't know, probably drinking Kool-Aid or iced tea, whatever we did back in the 80s. And yes, I did say the 80s. Maybe it was the 90s. Let's make me younger. But she point blank asked me if I knew who Jesus was. And I think I was taken aback a little. And I was like, well, yeah, I guess. You know, Santa, Christmas, things like that. But she asked me if I wanted to know who he was. And so she went on to explain how important he was in her life, and how, you know, he was the center of her life, and that he made life easier and better. You know, as a 12 and 13 year old would discuss, we aren't talking theology scholars. But she asked me if I wanted Jesus in my life, and in my head I was thinking, to make life easier? Sure. Why not? And so she gave me a prayer to pray when I went home that night. And so I got into bed, and I prayed that prayer, and it was a very simple one. Simply, Jesus, I want you in my life. I'd like to say that I woke up the next morning and everything was transformed, but that was not the case. Life went on as usual. I still felt like I didn't belong. I wasn't suddenly popular, which was the measure of my life at the time. But I firmly believe that that is the moment where God began working in a very powerful and different way in my life. But again, I still had that longing to belong, and I went off to college a year early. I graduated when I was 16 just to get out of Dodge, and I ended up at the University of Iowa, and trying to fit in, I got into the party scene and started drinking, and I went to the hospital that Thanksgiving with alcohol poisoning as a 17-year-old. And if you don't know, when you are 17 and taken to the emergency room, no matter what time of the night it is, they call your parents because you're a minor. So that was a very interesting conversation. But from there, I still had that idea of longing and trying to figure out why I was alive, why I was here. I knew I was loved, but what was my purpose beyond that? Clearly God wanted me here. But why? Christmas, we went off to California. So my Jewish godparents and my Hindu parents and I went to a Catholic monastery who had a homeless shelter. And we served that morning, Christmas morning. We served breakfast and we handed out presents to the children. And so I was one of the ones who handed out presents to the children, and I was paired with a newly minted 21-year-old young Marine named Eli. And God has a sense of humor, because I think I was 19 at the time, and he knew the way to my heart was a cute Marine named Eli. But he was helping that morning because it was actually his 21st birthday, and being a devout Baptist, he did not want to be on the base where they would pressure him to drink. And so he decided that the best way to celebrate his birthday was to give back. And this blew my mind, because there is not one friend that I had in college that would spend their 21st birthday not bar hopping. So we got to talking about who Jesus was and why he was doing what he was doing, and that really instilled a curiosity in me to learn more. So I started going to different churches, and my best friend in college kind of saw what I was doing and invited me to come to church with her. And she went to the Newman Center, the Catholic campus ministry on campus. And the very first Mass that I went to during the Elevation of the Eucharist, which is, for those of you who aren't Catholic, it's where they hold the host, the body of Christ, up. During the Elevation, I had this mystical experience where I knew it was Jesus, and I knew that I needed him. And I asked her after Mass, how do I receive him? Before Mass, she had, of course, told me that I couldn't, and we went through, you know, the simple reasons for that. So I entered RCIA right away, and I, you know, became Catholic in the spring of 1996, Easter Vigil, and life was great after. Except that's not really true, because we know that's not how that works. Not even a year after I came into the church, my dad passed away, and so in some ways I feel that God was providential in calling me to himself when he did, because he knew I would be losing my earthly father, and he gave me a father in heaven that was able to console me during all of that time, and gave me a family that really wrapped themselves around me during that time. But as it would happen, it was also my senior year, and so I moved away quite quickly after that. The thing about grief is they tell you not to make any really big moves or big decisions within the first couple of years. And well, we moved from Iowa down to Texas, so that was a really big decision. But I ended up in grad school with some beautiful people, and again, another family away from family, but not necessarily going to church, because I didn't have that habit yet. So I had just come into the church, and then I kind of fell away again before I really ever established myself. But my graduate supervisor was Catholic, and so she and her husband would gently invite me to Mass with them. So God is persistent, and he is just, he's a relentless pursuer of our hearts, right? And so that's grad school. I'm not really going to church because I'm not understanding exactly yet what all of this new life in Christ is. But I have this person who is inviting me, and so I go with her, and on and off, you know, it's nothing regular. And then I moved to Michigan, because I was actually trying to get back to Iowa, or out to D.C. where my friends were, and Michigan was the closest that I got. And on my interview committee here was the Catholic campus minister, who became a dear friend. So God is persistent, and he is, gosh, he's got a sense of humor. Because I happened to mention to my dear friend that one of my favorite experiences in campus ministry when I came into the church was going on retreats. And she said, here, you're on our retreat team. And I'm like, I don't think you understand. I haven't been to church in a couple years, and I just came in 2 or 3 years ago. She said, no, you're on our team. Because the surest way to learn is to do. And that began a slow surrender into the arms of God. You know, I converted with kind of a scent of heart back in 1996. You know, that idea of needing somewhere to belong, and Jesus invited me in. But I didn't fully surrender my heart to him, probably until years later. And every day is a new conversion. Every day. And I'm still searching. And there are still things that happen in my life that make me question where I am and what I'm doing and what is my purpose and who is God. But he relentlessly pursues us through my marriage, through my family, through my mom's death. I mean, all of this. Here we are today. And I think that the biggest story of my life is that God never gives up on you. God never, ever gives up on me. And it isn't about having the right words. It's not about doing the right things. But it's keeping that open heart to hear his voice and to take his lead and to take his hand and keep walking towards the cross and onto heaven. And gosh, if I can just keep doing that every day, and if I can have some friends in that journey, which I do, I have such beautiful friends who have helped me along the way, that have pointed me to Christ in so many different ways and helped me to get to know so many different facets of who he is and who I am through him. And I'm just so grateful for that. And so that is, if you would believe it, the abridged version of my story, because there are so many other little subplots within that story of the ebb and flow of how I've come to the Lord and where I am in my faith, where I'm in my life. We'll dig into more of my story as we go on through the podcast, but that's the abridged version. I hope to be able to dig into some of your stories in future episodes here in this place in between too, because this isn't about me. This is about all of us. And we get a better picture of what is going on in the world when we begin to listen to all the voices that are out there, to hear the voice of the one who gives us life. That's all for this episode of A Place in Between. Here's to hearing more of our stories in the hope of a fuller understanding of this beautiful picture that's being painted in this place in between. If you want to be part of the conversation, follow us on Facebook at A Place in Between Podcast. Do you have a story that you'd like to share? Contact me through our Facebook page.